Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vashon.
And good morning and welcome to the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show here on the Voice of Vashon. We're located on beautiful Vashon Island, Washington. And that was the voice of Brian Brown, the creator of the Brown Briefly. Brian started the Briefly and brought his high standards of intelligent discussion and current events laced with humor and empathy. Brian's motto was, less is more, more or less, and he always offered more, obviously. Today, our Briefly panel includes the legal eagle, consensus builder, former Washington State Assistant Attorney General and Fulbright Scholar, and my partner, Treetop Flyer, Mr. Craig Bellis. How are you, Craig?
I'm good, and I'm happy that you're back with us, Truman.
Well, thanks. Yeah, oh, yeah, this, I was off last week. I forgot. Yeah, feeling a little better. Thank you. Avid defender of justice, mariner, cyclist, and former top secret engineer, Mr. Kevin Jones. Good morning, Kevin.
Hey, that's me. Good to see you.
There he is. Historian, professor, and also a mariner and down under aficionado, Dr. Bruce Hallman. Good morning, Bruce.
Hey, good to be here.
And absent today is our fairy maven and part-time politico, playwright, executive director of the Vashon household, and full-time Shitty Hannigan's coordinator, Amy Dreher. She's off on a, I think, a low-income housing conference or something today. I'm Truman O'Brien. I'm an airport commissioner and partner of Treetop Flyer. I'm sitting behind the big red switch here in the Gene Bosch broadcast studio in downtown Vashon. And today I am absolutely honored to host our small talk guest, Mr. David Auburn. Good morning, David. Are you with us?
Good morning. Yes, thanks for having me.
There you go. I didn't have your volume quite up high enough yet. David is a Pulitzer and Tony Award-winning playwright, screenwriter, theater director, and he joins us today via Zoom to tell us about the new play, Summer of 1976. Just Summer 1976, not Up, which is being presented by the Vashon Repertory Theater. And it is the West Coast premiere. It's not this weekend, it's next weekend. I got that a little bit ahead of myself here. In fact, I think when we posted it on show notes, I had the wrong date. It's the May 3rd, is that correct? It's going to be, yeah. Sorry about that.
People are going to be showing up to watch the play here.
They probably will be. Darn
somebody,
it.
You should go down there. And
I should probably. Well, David, can you come out a week early? And no, I'm just kidding.
Sure. Yeah, I'll come out and perform it. Solo.
Yeah. There you go. Hey, before we jump into the small talk section, let's just take a minute, and go around the table, and find out what's going on with everybody this past week. Craig, how about we start with you?
Oh, not much, although I had a birthday on Saturday.
Oh, that's right.
And memorialized by the lead song in Music Man, having to deal with the number of trombones.
I was going to say, I got it now. Sorry, I'm a little slow.
That's okay. It's early. It's still a.m.
Yeah.
And then I celebrated, my wife, had a number of, she always surprises me and does a lot of wonderful things for me on my birthday. But I spent part of the day rebuilding my lawnmower. So,
that's the thing to do on your birthday.
Successfully, too, I might add. And it runs like a top. It's so good, as a matter of fact, you have to run behind it now.
Good.
That was my week.
Okay, Bruce, how about you?
Well, this was a weekend for grandkids. My grandson, youngest grandson, August, had his third birthday.
Oh boy!
This weekend, and his parents had a party for him, and they rented a bouncy house. And if you've ever seen 15 3-year-olds bouncing in a bouncing house, it's sort of like it's the image of monkeys gone wild. It's just sort of like it's, but it was a kick. They all just had a blast. And then later that day, went to the first baseball game for my 2 7-year-olds, Haven and Theodore. And they both, it's always interesting watching 7-year-olds try and handle a bat. It's sort of like their eye-hand coordination is
not quite there.
But it gets close. And they both got hits and at least made it to base. But this is these are the years when the coaches are doing the pitching. It's one step beyond T-ball, but it's not into real baseball. And then last night in practice, my 11-year-old grandson, Parker, hit his first home run ever.
Whoa.
And he was pumped.
Wow.
And it's just sort of like, okay, I did a home run.
You know? All right, cool.
So it was kind of a grandkids weekend, but with this glorious weather, why not?
Right? Absolutely. Absolutely.
From now on, April 15th will be known for that event.
There
you go. How about you, Kevin?
Well, it's been kind of an eventful week, a lot of different types of activities. But I will say that people should put on their calendars April 19th, this Saturday, because that is a notable day in the potential concerns coming from the administration about a report that's due, I think, from the Justice Department about how they might act in our communities. So if you're planning, if you have some time on Saturday, show up about 11 o'clock at the four-way stop for a couple hours. Our focus is going to be on people who've been disappearing from their communities, and we want to draw attention to that, say their names, bring them home. So look for that. There'll be some other indicators around town about how you can join that. But other than that, let's see, a beautiful day out today. I was able to ride the bike up here to the studio.
Yeah, saw you in your bike outfit, man. Cool.
Yeah, I'm getting some more road miles in, get the dust shaken off the old two-wheeler. Spent another weekend in Gig Harbor on the boat, so that was nice. A lot of fun. And, you know, when you join the Vashon Island Rowing Club, eventually, you know, you come up this learning curve, and you just never know what the coach is going to do on any given day. But today was the day the coach decided was my first ride in a single
boat.
And, it's amazing how tippy those things are. But, you know, I stayed dry through the whole day, so that's one measure of success. But, moving up the learning curve there on the rowing squad as well.
Good. So, David, how has your week been?
It's been good. It's a busy time of year. My younger daughter is finishing up her time at Trinity College in Dublin. She's coming home pretty soon, so we have to get ready for that. We're looking forward to that. And, you know, a lot of work, the world is a very busy place right now. A lot of certain amount of activism has been occupying my time. So, it's been a busy week.
And you live in New York, in the city?
We live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to make sure of that. Well, my week was pretty uneventful, except that a couple of days ago, you know, I have 5 horses. I don't know if you know that, live in my house. And one thing about horses is you push hay in the front end, and compost comes out of the rear end. And it's not compost when it first comes out. It's you have to make compost. And I have a compost bin where there are 3 big bins. You put the fresh stuff in one, and then after it gets full, you move it to the middle and fill it up again. And then once that gets full, you move it 3 times. And then you have a wonderful compost at the end. And all my friends that have gardens come and take that compost away, which is fabulous. And somebody said, well, you should charge them for that. And I said, I'd pay them to take it. Come on, are you kidding? I'm ready to be out of there with it.
They did that in New York, too, at one time, I hear.
Yeah. Oh, that's another story.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. So, hey, today is a significant day, obviously. Now, this one gets me. It's National Laundry Day. I have no idea.
Susie's doing laundry today.
Well, there you go.
She's way onto things.
She's celebrating.
I ran a load this morning myself.
Yeah, I helped move clothes from the washer to the dryer.
There you go.
Yeah, we're all in.
There it is. We're all
cranking the dryer. You know, we're taking the clothes through the crank.
yeah, there. And of course, today is National Tax Day. It's the last day of filing for your federal income tax return. So I hope all you folks have got your taxes in.
Tick tock.
There you go.
Better get an extension if you haven't.
Well, you got to pay though if you haven't. I mean,
If you owe. Yeah, if there's anybody doing
course, it depends whether there's anybody the IRS to check.
Well,
right?
Boy, isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? Hey, some really great birthdays today. Emma Thompson, Chris Stapleton, Seth Rogen, and Emma Watson. They all have birthdays today.
And Emma.
In fact, several more, actually, which I didn't cover. But today in history, in 1861, the Federal Army of 75,000 volunteers is mobilized by Abraham Lincoln to start of the Civil War. That was this today, 1861. And, of course, 4 years later, Abraham Lincoln died 9 hours after he was shot by John Wilkes Booth while attending the play Our American Cousin at Ford's Theater in Washington. But it was the next day that he actually passed away. 1912, RMS Titanic sinks at 2:29 a.m. off Newfoundland with a loss of approximately 1,500 people. And I found that really interesting. I made a couple of notes about that. The fact that they don't really know how many people were lost. And that's because the original passenger and crew list had a bunch of inaccuracies, misspellings, omissions, aliases. And the other thing is they didn't count the contract players like the orchestra and all that stuff, which I thought was really interesting. So our people say it was 1,517, and the British counterpart determined it as 5,003. So there you go. A lot of folks on that day. Sad day. What else we have? Or another quick thing. 1947, number 42, Jackie Robinson became the first African-American to play in a U.S. Major League Baseball game, the Brooklyn Dodgers, which I thought was kind of interesting. And last but not least, 1955, Ray Kroc opens his very first McDonald's fast food restaurant in Des Plaines, Illinois. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. And did he make the shoes too, the Crocs shoes?
Yeah, no. That's a C-R-O-C, not K-R-O-C.
Just had to check on that.
Yeah,
you did
right.
The research, so.
Indeed. Okay, hey, guys, we're getting into our small talk thing here. I'm really pleased and excited to introduce again David Auburn, who's, as we began, the custom of the Brown Briefly, we need to ask, give us a little bit of a bio of yourself, David. When Craig starts, he always says, I was born 6 pounds, 7 ounces, and we don't expect you to go quite that far back, but just a little bio.
Okay. Well, I as you said, I'm a playwright and work in film as well, and direct plays. I've been doing that for about 25 years. I was born in Chicago, but mostly grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and in Arkansas.
Oh.
In two different places in Arkansas, Jonesboro, which is near Memphis, and Little Rock. And I went back to Chicago for school, and then eventually made my way to New York, where I started, trying to get into the theater, which was what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to try to build a career as a playwright, and I began working wide variety of jobs and doing things to support myself, in the time it took to do that. And I essentially been doing that ever since.
Wow. That is amazing. I can't even imagine the amount of effort that it would take to get that job done. I mean, it just has to be really overwhelming in my mind anyway. So one of the things we want to talk about today is your play, Summer 1976. And without giving too much away, can you tell us a little bit about what the play is about?
Sure. I mean, most of the play is about two women who they live in Columbus, Ohio, and they're young mothers, and they meet one summer because they both need help caring for their small kids, and they become friends. And the bulk of the play is concerned with this one summer when they become very close. They begin to rely upon each other. They help each other question their lives, reexamine their lives somewhat. And then at the end of the summer, they begin to drift apart. And the play is sort of about what happened. Why does this friendship fade away? What does it mean to them? And how does it affect the course of their lives going forward? There's a kind of epilogue in which they meet many years later, and they're evaluating everything that this summer meant to them.
Hmm. I know that a play is all dialogue. I mean, that's what the play is. But, I think that writing dialogue, and particularly between two women, would be difficult. And did you have something in particular that you use for influences for that? Or,
Well, the play really started as an exercise for me to try to write some monologues. That was something that I've not done very much in my other work. And I wanted to try to write some longer pieces. So perhaps there would be solo pieces for actors. Mm. And as I was sort of casting around for a starting point, I remembered, I thought, well, I'll just draw on some memories of my childhood. Mm-hmm. the play isn't autobiographical in any sense, but I did just sort of begin plucking out images and small memories of things that I remember from being a kid in the 70s in Ohio, and gradually built up these monologues. And then at a certain point, the two characters, almost without my thinking about it too much, broke out of the monologues and began talking directly to each other. So I just sort of let that happen. I mean, I tried not to question where the play was going, and when these people just started to talk to each other, I let it happen and tried to follow where it went. And so and when that happens, that's the best part of creative work, when you feel that you're not entirely in control of it, that something else is taking over.
I've heard that many times from people saying, "Oh, the song wrote itself," or, but I can see where that conversation started, and then you just would answer the thing that was said to you. I mean,
Yeah,
what?
you just sort of try to inhabit their experiences and their lives as much as you can imaginatively, and you try to honor what you think their intentions would be in the situation that you put them in, and see where it goes. It doesn't exactly write itself because there's obviously a lot of revision and a lot
Oh,
of
sure.
thinking that takes place afterward, but hopefully you can at least have a part of the process that feels spontaneous.
You know, David, my name's Craig here, and I lived in Ohio for many years, up north by Oberlin College. My understanding is you just instructed us on this a moment ago. You lived in Columbus for a while, so it seemed like a natural that you would pick the Ohio State University.
That's right.
Yeah.
Although someone called it that when I was a kid, that I recall. I don't remember when
No, I
that became
know.
part of branding.
Yeah, they changed that over time. Now you always get corrected if you just say
State,
Ohio
Ohio State.
State. But I assume you thought that the center of Ohio or much of Ohio was a great place for a bit of a culture clash between two individuals. Is that, and it's what you knew. It's what you were familiar with. Is that an accurate statement?
That's right. I mean, I'm looking back. I'm kind of surprised at how vivid my memories are of my parents' friends. My dad taught at the Ohio State University, and a lot of my friends were other kids who were associated with the university. So I had that to draw upon. The specific thing that really got the place started was, I remember that my mom had run this babysitting co-op, which was kind of a sort of post-hippie, almost utopian kind of project where nobody, so that young couples without a lot of money didn't have to pay for babysitting. My mother made these coupons. She had a stamp, and she made these sort of shares that were distributed to the group, and people could trade them theoretically. You'd babysit, get a coupon, then you'd pay for someone else when you needed it. And this exchange would take place and would perpetuate itself ideally, but of course it never worked. Nothing.
Of course.
Every one person ran out, and the other person had too many shares, but the idea of the two women who meet because they initially are members of this kind of ramshackle co-op, both seemed interesting to me dramatically, and also seemed very typical of the time in that sort of mid-70s period.
That running out of coupons, Truman, sounds like our poker game
I was going to say.
That is a story there for
Exactly.
sure.
Exactly.
Well, David, the summer's 1976. 76 has some interesting historical connotations. How did you select 1976? And perhaps was it the United States Bicentennial?
That had a lot to do with it. At first, the play was set in the 70s sometime, but I didn't know when. But as I worked on it gradually, it seemed like one of the main themes that was emerging was the theme of independence, and these women, young women, both of whom were feel trapped in various ways, struggling with how to break out of what they feel are the strictures they're encountering. So the bicentennial summer just seemed like the right time to put the play. And I certainly have very, also very vivid memories of that summer and all of the events. And just the spirit of the time. And even though I wrote the play several years ago, when it came up for production 2 years ago, we were heading into the election. There was a sense that maybe things wouldn't turn out the way many of us hoped. And, you know, looking back at a time which was at least in some ways more hopeful or more conventionally patriotic also felt poignant to me and interesting.
So David, a couple questions for you. I really enjoyed The Lake House as a film and the construct behind it. I mean, it's a very interesting kind of concept. What led you into that?
Thank you. No, that's a movie that I wrote with Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock. It was loosely based on a Korean film called Yomare that had the basic premise of these two people who are separated in time but are able to communicate. And the studio, I think it was Warner Brothers, had the rights to that, and they wanted to recast it as an American story. So I took that basic premise and we worked it into The Lake House. So I can't claim any credit for the basic idea, but it's a moving notion of people who are separated by something that they can't control, but manage to communicate across that divide.
Yeah, it was a fascinating film. So you've worked both in the theater and in film and written and production kind of things. How are they different and how are they similar?
The main thing is when you're a playwright, you, just on a legal level, you own your play. And the theater has option, basically the rights to produce it. But the playwright's really at the center of the process and you can determine what ends up on stage. It's a very different story with the movies. You sell a movie script. And so it essentially you're an employee and they can do whatever they want with the script. They can, you know, they can hire someone else to rework it. They can change one line. They can change everything. So you're just in a different relationship to the work. And, you know, movie work can be very fun and satisfying also. I've enjoyed most of the movie projects I've been involved with, but it's a little bit more like being a contractor, I would say, on a project where you've been called in to put a roof on somebody on a house, you know, and they want to pay you well and they want you to do a good job and they don't want the roof to leak, but it's not your house. With a play, it is your house, and that can be very satisfying.
Yeah, sort of following up on that a little bit, and maybe you can expand on this. In the post-production, you know, after the script's been done, you know, you talked a little bit about how different they are between theater and film. How much engaged are you after a play goes into production?
It really depends. I mean, with this play, I think the Vashon production will be, I think, the fifth one I've seen. And with a couple of them, I've been a little more engaged, but if I know the person who's directing it, I feel a little more confident about stepping back because I know what they're gonna do. In this case, Charlotte Tinkin is the director and she's someone I've known almost all of my life. I mean, it's one of the really nice things about this production for me is getting a chance to get back together with Charlotte. When I lived in Little Rock as a teenager, she was a stage manager at the Arkansas Arts Center Children's Theater. And she mentored me and countless other teenagers who volunteered to do stuff at that theater. So it's enormously gratifying to me to get to come back 40 years later, or maybe even a little bit more. I think let's say 40. I don't think it's more than 40. But to get to work with her again. So that's just all a way of saying I haven't been closely involved with any of the rehearsals or anything. I have a lot of confidence in Charlotte and we've had really good conversations about the play. I'm excited to see what she does with it.
You know, not too long ago, Charlotte, the Vashon Repertory Theater did a reading. It was during International Women's Day. And they did several readings of plays, and one of them, we interviewed the two playwrights, and in fact, it was a musical, and one woman who's a physician wrote the music, And then the other woman, who was a playwright, wrote the play. And they were very involved. I mean, because this was the first reading, they were doing rewrites and stuff on the fly. But does that sort of thing happen in a major production? I mean, I'm thinking in particular, you had Laura Linney, who was in the production that was in New York of this play. And were you involved in that? And are there rewrites and things that happen during the production, or?
Yes, it's a different story with the premiere. I mean, we had this play premiered in 2023 mm-hmm. on Broadway with Laura Linney and Jessica Hecht. I wouldn't say the script changed a whole lot, but there were definitely things in it that changed during the rehearsal period, and there were things that I honestly wasn't sure how they would work once we got in front of an audience. I mean, you're never entirely sure. Mm-hmm. And so there were sort of big question marks as to what would happen when we finally started performing it. The nice thing about opening a play at a large theater in New York is you have 3 weeks of previews generally. So that does give you some time to hear what the audience response is and to make adjustments based on that. And certainly for about the first, I would say, week and a half, 2 weeks of performances, we were rehearsing every afternoon. I was bringing in new pages. Mm. We were trying different things and making adjustments, and that's very typical. And, you know, Laura Linney is the pro of pros and has been through this process many, many times and was wonderful about accommodating changes. Both she and Jessica Hecht were. And that's a luxury for a playwright to have someone who is so game, because it's a scary thing for them, too, to go out with some, you know, new lines or part of a new scene mm-hmm. one night when they've only rehearsed it a few times that afternoon, and to have to make try to make it work in front of an audience. But, you know, these people are the best, and they did it.
You know, that it reminds me, I saw Something Wicked This Way Comes, I believe. I can't remember now the play, but it was one that they had just come out and did in New York, and they saw it on Broadway. And one of the first production numbers, it was a big production number, and at the end of the production number, they had a standing ovation from the audience in the middle of the play, you know, and all the actors are looking at each other like, what the heck is this? You know, they just couldn't believe that they had that kind of a response. So I would imagine that, like you were saying, in these premieres, you're getting a lot of feedback from the audience, isn't that right, about what things work and what things don't.
There was something in this play particular, I don't want to give it away, but I think people will recognize it when they see the play. There's a particular moment that I knew that the audience would react in some extreme way, but I didn't know what kind of reaction it would be.
Yeah.
Neither did the director, and we discussed it, and neither of us were sure if it would be a good reaction, if it would be a problematic reaction, if it would, you know, we didn't know what would happen. And so the first night when it did happen, and it was very good, and it did work, but it worked wonderfully, but in a way that neither of us had quite anticipated. It was one of those moments where you think this can only happen in the theater, and this is why you like working in the theater, because because of the opportunity to surprise yourself.
That's fantastic. That I find that fascinating, that you can get that vibe from the audience, and then it really it kind of informs you in the direction that you need to go with that.
Yep.
You know,
very much so.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, the Vashon Repertory Theater recently did a series of readings for International Women's Day, mm-hmm. and you, having written a play about women or involving two women. Did you have any special events scheduled for that day?
I didn't participate in it.
Well, let me follow up on that a little bit. You talked about this again at the just as we started talking to you, and I find it really interesting about when a man writes a book or a play about women. And from the mind of a woman, the one that comes to mind right away is Wally Lamb's She's Come Undone, which I consider a great book, but he got a lot of feedback on how did you put yourself in the mind of the woman in that particular play? You, I assume, when you started writing this play, sat down by yourself to sort of to write the play, and then started getting perhaps feedback from women. How did that work?
I certainly got feedback. I got feedback from from my wife and
good feedback.
Yeah, she said she liked it. No, I mean, she's a very perceptive, blunt critic, and I rely on her a lot. But in a way, I don't know if it's so different from writing about anything. I mean, I've written plays about mathematicians. I'm not a mathematician. I've written plays about newspaper columnists in the 1960s. I wasn't that either. The writing is about sort of trying to think your way imaginatively into someone else's point of view and to imagine and dramatize what might be going on in their lives. So in some ways, the gender of the character is the least important thing. What's most important is what do they want? What do they care about? What bothers them? What are they trying to do in the story?
Yeah. That makes eminent sense. I'm also curious, and again, you've touched upon this, but when you've finished, well, I guess that sort of begs the question, when do you finish writing the play? I assume that there's revisions after revisions after revisions as you go through the process. How do you actually get it onto the stage? You've written several great plays. Have they all followed the same process, or have they differed somewhat in terms of how you got them actually into stage production?
I've been pretty lucky with a number of my plays that I have a relationship with a theater, Manhattan Theater Club in New York City, which, historically has made commitments to writers over long periods of time. And they're a theater that prides itself on, doing someone's body of work, and I've really benefited from that. So I know that if I write a new play, I can always send it to MTC and have them take it seriously. It doesn't mean they'll necessarily produce it, but in the last plays I've written, I've been lucky that they've taken them on and put them into some kind of production process. So that's how it's, and as a kind of mid-career playwright, I'm lucky to have. Well, I hope I'm mid-career. I could be late career, right? But as wherever I am, I'm lucky to have, over the years built a number of relationships like that.
Hope you're in your early career.
I was thinking that myself, actually. Yeah.
So David, I think I caught early on in our discussion a reference to the timing of when the play premiered. Relative to an upcoming election cycle. And I don't know if I really picked up on that or not, but what I'm curious about is that, we're largely facing some pretty different times in terms of challenges and, disruptions in our society. To what extent do you try to include that and bring that into the dialogue or the activities that occur on the stage in your plays?
I'm not sure. I mean, whenever you go to see a play, you're going to be bringing in everything that you have been dealing with in your life, that year, that day. Sometimes it's really wonderful when the play can help you engage with the problems that are out there in the world. Sometimes it's nice if the play can help you forget those things.
Right, yeah.
Something else, So I don't really know. I mean, this play obviously doesn't bear directly on anything that's happening right now politically, although there is some politics in it. And I'd really be happy if it just allows people, in some sense, to check out of our current moment and look back, which is what the women in the play are doing. Look back at an earlier time in their lives and when they were different, when things were different, when the country was different. That to me is just as valuable as spending more time wrestling with what we're all wrestling with.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, I'm a historian, so I always sort of look at the world through historical eyes, if you will. And I just wondered, you talked a little bit about 1976 and how that helped inform sort of the background of the place, sort of, you know, the sort of stuff that's not necessarily in the dialogue, but sort of surrounding it. And I just wondered, in terms of, you've done some really interesting things with, like, Skyscraper, about historical preservation, proof, a particular moment in mathematical historical times, if you will, and the columnists, you know, Joseph Alsop, and sort of, you know, the role, dominant role he played in, as a columnist in Washington, D.C. You know, how much historical research do you do, and how do you do that, and how do you incorporate it? Because it's really not the foreground of the play, but it informs the background of it.
With this play, I did very little research. I mean, the research was my own life to an extent. I mean, I tried to do something which I haven't really done before, which is just to let whatever memories and impressions I have from the time when I was about 7 or 8 years old bubble up, and to see what I could do with them. You know, talking about things like a woman, you know, I remember a friend of my mom's had a big macrame wall hanging that said, "A woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle."
Yeah, right. I remember that.
Happy images.
Yeah.
Bookshelves made of, you know, boards and cinder blocks, yeah. And that kind of like semi-bohemian academic young couples painting their own houses in the summertime and things like that. So I just tried to have a kind of impressionistic approach for a lot of it. Other plays have required more research, but this one really didn't.
So I have a personal question. You said that with a film that you sell the script to the film, to the film company, and then they take it and do with it as they will. So obviously there's a cash exchange for that script. When you do a play, do you get residuals from all of the performances, or is this, how does that work financially for you?
Yes, generally the theater pays some kind of fee to option the play for a certain period of time, and then you get royalties based on how many people are coming to see it. And then if the, you know, what you really hope is that the play has a life beyond the initial production, so that as it's produced around the country and hopefully internationally, that you have some kind of revenue stream from that.
So there's basically royalties, as you would say, correct?
It's a royalty, yes. Yeah. It's a royalty. Oh. And it's based on ticket sales.
Oh, it is. Oh. So if you have a play that's a real hot one, you'll do better than if you have one that kind of bombs, I would assume, then.
Sure. No, the more people are buying tickets, the better you are, better off you are.
Interesting. You know, I have to say that I screwed up on the date, and I apologize about that. But the actual play is going to be produced, and I'm trying to find my notes here now. It's going to be May 1st at 7:30 is a dress rehearsal. And then on Friday, May 2nd at 7:30 is a performance. And then Saturday, May 3rd at 2 o'clock and at 7:30. So there's a matinee and an evening play. And then Sunday on May 4th, there's also a matinee. Now, I understand there's a talk back. So are you going to be, you'll be here for the talk back? Or?
Yes, I'm coming in. I'm very excited. I'm going to be there for the opening and for the talk back and also for an event, I think, at Seattle Rep. So I'm really looking forward to being in the Seattle area.
Great. And have you been here before?
I have. Yeah. I have. It's been a while, but I love it there, and I'm eager to come back.
Great. And have you ever been to Vashon?
I've not been to Vashon.
Oh, you're in for a treat.
We're going to spend 2 or 3 days there, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Excellent. Let us know, and we'll give you a tour of the studio. I'm sure you're excited to see that.
Hey, Truman. Tickets.
Oh, yeah. Tickets are $20. No, excuse me, $32 for general admission, $30 for seniors. That's all of us guys. And and it says it's not suitable for children under 16. So it's an R-rated performance. Is that correct?
It's a very low, I would say it's too, I think it's PG-13, but
Okay, there you
I
go.
won't tell people not to.
All right.
And I assume you get the tickets either from what, Vashon Center
VCA.
for the Arts, is probably the primary place.
Yep. Gentlemen, other questions, other comments?
It's just, let's go back to when you were in Arkansas and working with Charlotte as a teenager. I mean, what got you interested in the theater in the first place? Did you conceive of yourself as behind the scenes writing the play, on the stage being the lead actor? I mean, what were the motivations in your, 14, 16-year-old mind at that point?
I did a little bit of everything. One of the motivations was my family moved a number of times when I was a kid. And if you move around a lot, you look for a way to plug yourself into some kind of new social situation quickly when you get to a new place. I wasn't a very good athlete. I didn't play sports on teams. So the theater was a good way to do that. And, you do the school theater, you go to the local community theater, you very quickly meet people. And you're doing fun things and staying up late and climbing on ladders and, doing interesting things. So that was one of the big sources of appeal for me. I was also taken to the theater a lot as a kid. My parents were both, it was important to both of my parents. My dad taught literature and drama at Ohio State. And so that was part of his life. And, so it was always in the sort of air we breathed, and I just liked being around theater people.
So speaking of the university, what is your educational background, David? Did you go through the university itself, or?
I went to the University of Chicago. I got a degree in English, and that's more or less the extent of my formal education. I did spend a few years at the Juilliard School as a playwright in residence, which, although it wasn't a degree program, I learned a lot there and had some professional, some professional immersion there that I had never had before. So I would include that in my education. That's pretty much it.
I just got a note from Susan McCabe, who is one of the folks that works with Charlotte Dinkin a lot. And she said let me see if I can just read this. Let me get it here. Okay, yeah. She said that tickets are available at the Vashon Repertory Theater .org. Sorry, Vashon Repertory Theater .org. Tickets are available there. And she also asked that we ask you what would make people excited to come see this play? What would be exciting for them to make them want to come and see the play?
Well, I would say it's very funny.
Ah,
okay. At the risk of being immodest, I think it's a very funny play. I think it's and people, even though the play deals with some difficult issues and has moments of drama in it, I think it's a very fun theatrical experience, the way it's structured and some of the other things, the surprises that unfold along the way. So yes, I think you will have a good time.
Remember that dramatic event discussion we had earlier, so hey, there's that.
There you go. You're going to be looking for that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How long is the play, by the way, and is it an intermission or?
It's 90 minutes. There's no intermission. That may be another selling point for people. It's relatively short.
Yeah. My wife and I go down to Ashland, Oregon every year for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And this particular year, they had two of the plays that we saw were 90 minutes with no intermission. And yeah, it's interesting. It runs well. I mean, you're quite comfortable doing all of that.
Yes, it can be nice, and you can have dinner afterward. And
yeah, exactly.
That can be pleasant.
Gentlemen, no? Well, we have about 10 minutes left here, folks. And We're wondering if you want to take the topic of the day, gentlemen.
Which is the topic of the day? I can't, it's hard to keep track.
They changed the tariffs.
There's the military parade.
Military parade.
You name it.
What do folks think in New York? I mean, what's the feeling about our administration in New York itself? I mean, what do they think of the Donald in New York?
Well, where I live is not MAGA territory, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
And I would say, in general, New Yorkers have we've been living with Donald Trump for 40 or 50 years,
right.
And people are very, very familiar with who he is and how he works. And my general impression is that people in New York had fewer illusions going into even the first administration about, for example, his savviness as a businessman, you know, right. or his ability to do deals. I think New Yorkers had seen through all that a long, long time ago. So that may be one difference between New York and the rest of the country, because he's a New York creature.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the thing that I thought.
Yeah, let me follow up with a question. You wrote about Joseph Alsop and as a columnist during the McCarthy era. What did you see in that, and what kind of things did you take away from that inform what you see going on today?
Alsop was a really interesting character. I mean, if people don't know, he was one of the country's most prominent political columnists, and he was hugely influential, especially on the Johnson administration. He was a real cold warrior, but he was also a liberal, you know, liberal New Deal Democrat, kind of FDR Democrat. And things really changed for him after JFK was assassinated. He had idolized JFK and been very close to him, and had even entertained JFK at his apartment on the night of the inauguration. And so when Kennedy died, he was really devastated, and it seemed to change him politically. And a lot of the play that I wrote was just about how does someone turn to reactionary politics? What happens? Why do some people go in that direction, even after a lifetime of being progressive or liberal? And I don't know. I still don't have a great answer for that. But my answer, as I watch what's happening to many people in the country, particularly many people in the administration who you might have thought would have been more resistant to it than they've turned out to be, it seems to come down to some kind of emotional need that they have. I mean, that was true of Alsop. He had personal grievances and injuries that pushed him to the right. And that sort of short-circuited his rationality and made him do things that he knew better than to do, but he did them anyway. And I just have to imagine that that's a lot of what's going on in our world today, that you have people whose emotional needs are sort of short-circuiting a lot of their more rational, more moral considerations. Quite how that works for each individual person, I couldn't tell you, but it's a fascinating and disturbing mystery, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. That is very enlightening. I've had friends who say, Donald is this great businessman. And I keep thinking, you know, you bankrupt a casino. You can't be that big a businessman. And your viewpoint of him as a New Yorker certainly confirms that for me.
Go ahead,
well,
Kevin.
The thought that came to mind for me the other day was, you know, the story is that he squandered his father's money.
Right.
And now he's squandering ours.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's exactly. Disturbing.
I don't know if you're familiar, David, with the Bill Maher dinner that he had with Trump here about a week ago or so, and he talked about it on his show. Are you up on that at all?
I saw someone reference it, but I wasn't quite sure what happened.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line, if I may, was after having the dinner with the Donald and Kid Rock, who kind of brought the two of them together, I guess, or they had mutual friends, was that Bill Maher was of the opinion that the real Donald Trump was sort of a gracious individual that listened to everything he had to say at the dinner, and the performative and Donald Trump was the one that you see on television in front of crowds. And the pushback on that has been rather remarkable, that kind of comes down to, Bill, you got it reversed. the real Donald Trump is the one you see yelling and doing all these various things, and the performative and con artist Donald Trump is the one you met at dinner. So I'm not sure you want to comment on that without having actually seen the interview or his show.
Well, it just seems like
that.
A very familiar, I mean, this is not new, right? I mean, there are so many examples in the past of people who consider themselves savvy going and, you know, having lunch or dinner with someone who's an authoritarian or a dictator and being charmed by them, because those people are capable of charm. If they weren't, they wouldn't have gotten where they are. Right. And then deciding that that means something really significant. But the fact that someone could sit with you and flatter you and charm you for an hour or two is just not very significant.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat
seriously.
Happy, I would say. Yeah.
So, I had a question for you about, there's a lot of struggling young playwrights and screenwriters out there. You've sort of gone through that. You've become very successful. What are your words of advice to a young person who's considering, playwriting, considering screenwriting, and there's lots of them out there? I mean, what words of wisdom do you have for young people?
The best thing you can do is find some kind of community. I mean, I think that's really not only the thing that sustains you, but also the way in, the way to sort of build a career. I think most careers, certainly in the theater, come out of people forming little groups, little theater companies, and working together and putting things on, not waiting for someone else to do your work, but producing yourself with a group of friends at whatever level you're able to do it. And building, you building your skills, building your experience, teaching each other, learning from each other, and eventually expanding out into the wider world. I think that's how most careers come about. And it's also sustaining. I mean, it's emotionally sustaining. Mm-hmm. You have fun and you have friends and you build bonds with people and you avoid loneliness, which can be hard to manage otherwise. So I think that's my advice. Find a community. Go where your friends are. Do make things with your friends, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's what's fascinating to me. 1976, when I saw the title of your film, of your play, it's that's the year that Dramadoc, which is one of the island sort of theater groups, was formed in 1976. Oh. So next year they're celebrating their whatever it is.
Was that 50th, 40th? 50th,
sort of a year of existence. And it's fascinating to me that they represent that very, very much what you just talked about. And so does Charlotte and the Vashon Repertoire Theater. I mean, it's people interested in theater who have come together and sort of have built these communities, if you will. And for Vashon Dramadoc, I mean, 50 years is not a bad run in a small community.
Yeah. Our own Amy Dreher, who's not here today, is a young playwright. She's written two plays, one that's been produced actually on Voice of Vashon. It was a radio play and was very good, I thought. I got the engineer for it, and I thought that was fascinating. And the one thing that you said that really struck home is that group was obviously adored each other. All of them, and they would support, when one of them had a particular line that was funny, or everybody was really into it, they were thrilled that person was getting that line and getting that response. It was really an interesting thing to watch, and I really appreciate that your advice for that, because I think it's huge.
Trying to remember the name of what the Vashon festival they do. They do it. It's 7/24 or something.
No, 14/24.
14/24. They produce 14 plays in 24 hours, and they put groups together sort of randomly, and you have 24 hours to write a play and then present it as a sort of a reading rather than a full production. And it's a kick to watch that happen. It's really a kick to watch people sort of go away and put their heads together and come back, and then 2 days later they put on a reading of a play. It's a fascinating sort of process, and it does create that kind of community you're talking about.
Absolutely. Well, folks, we're about out of time. I just want to take one more effort here and tell you that Thursday, May 1st, 7:30 is a dress rehearsal. And that's a pay what you will for that one. And then Friday, May 2nd, 7:30. Saturday, May 3rd, 2 o'clock matinee and 7:30 performance in the evening. On Sunday, May 4th, it's 2 p.m. matinee. And the talkback is going to be, now I don't see. Will there be a talkback after each production or just the matinees?
I only know about one talkback. I'm not sure what the other plans might be.
Okay, I'm not sure. Oh, wait a minute. I see it now. It's a past performance or post performance after the matinees, with Tony Award and Pulitzer Prize winning playwright David Auburn. Boy, we are thrilled to have you on, David, and we really appreciate your insights. And I personally am really looking forward to seeing the play, and I'm sure that. You're going to have a...
Well, thank you so much. It's been a privilege.
And we really enjoyed it. And so, folks, what's we got coming up here next week, Craig? Are you...
Well, we got something that's going to be very interesting. Sharon Nelson, our own Sharon Nelson, who was the Democratic leader of the state Senate for years, now retired, has decided that she wants to talk about what's going on in the United States, some of the threats and challenges and possible responses to the latest Trump executive orders and actions. So that should be a very enlightening show and one, Kevin, that will precede another event.
It's a prelude to Indivisible Vashon's Thursday night gathering. So you can hear Sharon on Tuesday on The Voice of Vashon, and then you can talk with Sharon on Thursday, and we'll be at the Vashon Methodist Church. And from doors open at 6:30, meeting starts at 7. We want to tell people a little bit about what Indivisible Vashon does, have Sharon talk about what she's expecting in this administration and unveiling some of her concerns. And then we're going to kind of break up into groups to say, you know, what are those things that we heard that we could do something about? So there's that opportunity. But there's a few other things. We have actually some plans for May 1st also, which do not involve the theater, although a little bit of theater. So we're going to be practicing first attempt at our theater is going to be again here on the four-way stop at the, this is going to be this Saturday the 19th. So if you want to join the little parade, show up at Snapdragon about 10:45 on Saturday. We'll walk to the four-way stop, get there about 11 o'clock. Empty chairs on the corners to represent people who are being disappeared in this country. The Supreme Court told the administration they need to facilitate the return of an individual who is currently in El Salvador. The administration appears to be telling the Supreme Court they're not going to follow that edict. Wow. So this is a very concerning time, given that kind of concern. Mm-hmm. So we want to draw attention to that, make people aware of what is happening, get them involved in participating in conversations like Sharon Nelson and what she has to say about those things. But then also on May 1st, a Cal Anderson Park Indivisible Vashon is planning to arrive there about noon at the first base of the baseball diamond to, again, talk about the folks who are no longer here in our open society. They've been spirited away somewhere. So if you'd like to participate in those things, join in. See you at the four-way stop on Saturday.
Okay, and just take one more moment to say thank you very much to David for being here today. We've thoroughly enjoyed chatting with him, and We look forward to seeing you all again next week on The Voice of Vashon. So The Brown Briefly will be at 11 o'clock next week and next Tuesday. And we hope you're all going to join us then.